Why, hello there. It's me, Jeremy, your favorite bald dude telling you about Standard & Strange, a store and a brand with simple rules. Sell clothes they themselves would wear, manufacture it ethically, and build it to last. From boots made in Oregon to loop wheel garments made in Japan, find all the best clothes for your wardrobe at Standard & Strange. StandardandStrange.com. Hey folks, it's Jeremy Kirkland. You're listening to Blammo. All right, new week, new pod. How we all doing? Went on a donut run today. I did, but I failed. I swear, something is not right here because I couldn't find donuts anywhere in my neighborhood. Like it's ridiculous. I went to the gym. I went absolutely nuts doing all the stupid stuff like ropes and ball slams and kettlebells. I had kettlebells flying everywhere over my head, around my back. I mean, I crushed it. I was really proud of myself. So I was like, okay, all right, big guy, we're getting a donut after this. We are celebrating. It's Friday. So I leave and I head to this place near me called the Donut Palace. I know it's a stupid name. It's not a palace. By the way, it was empty. And they had a sign out in front that said sold out on it. I'm like, what the F? Like, it's 10:30 in the morning. You're sold out? I mean, these things were popping. So I see, I kind of peer myself through the window. And I see this woman back there, and she's counting money like a drug dealer. And I wave to her. I hear her yell through the glass, oh, we're sold out. Like, she's, like, sold out. And she's, like, even, you know, like, moving her hand across her neck, like the whole kill sign, which I guess that means sold out. But here's the thing. They weren't sold out because I could see a friggin' tray of donuts in the window, this huge one that was, like, in the little glass case. I'm like, were they reserved? I try to point to it, and she keeps saying, sold out. No, no, no. So maybe those are like test donuts. Maybe they're wax donuts. I don't know, but there were no donuts and I was livid. And I realized I was hangry. You know, the whole thing, like hungry and angry together. I didn't invent that. Some idiot did. But like, I was like, well, maybe the big man upstairs is trying to tell me to chill out. So I'm like, okay, whatever. I get in my dumb car. I proceeded to this gas station and I got a gas station donut. I was like, this is going to solve everything. One of those blueberry cake, you know, this is a crappy donut, but I'm so focused on getting these stupid donuts. I hold it in my hand. It's in one of those little butcher paper bags and it snaps in half and it hits the ground. And the guy's like, oh, sorry, dude. I guess you got to buy it. Like kind of laughing. I'm like, for real? Come on, man. And I kind of like get pretty upset. Like I like get ready to throw down with this guy, but he was kidding. And I was like, look, I'll buy one that's not half on the ground. And he's like, dude, it's fine, man. Don't worry about it. And so he takes it, throws it away. I got back in my dumb car. I went home and I had a protein shake. I swear that was my day. That was my Friday morning. Swear to God. It's my life these days. I'm just cruising around, swinging kettlebells, trying to find a donut. It's like, aren't we all just looking for donuts? I'm saying. All right, enough of that crap. My guest this week is a good friend, incredible skateboarder, hilarious comedian and actor, Mort Burke. He's launching his new comedy special. It's out, I think, tomorrow. I should know this, right? I'm doing the intro. But I think it's out the 28th, which is poof, big time. But full disclosure, Mort was the guy who used to help me learn how to skateboard when I was young in St. Louis. He helped me learn how to kickflip. He would take me out and like teach me tricks and like vibe with me. I mean, he was a cool dude. And now he's level 99 cool dude. I mean, he's cool guy. He's Mort Burke. He's been on your favorite shows from Mythic Quest to Drunk History and The Mindy Project and more. We chat his new comedy special, Spiritually Filthy. Skateboarding, freaking out on airplanes, being polite, not drinking coffee, being sober. His friend Wayne, which you got to watch the special. It's pretty gnarly. Religion, best skate videos, and why so many people are obsessed with skateboarder style. Dude. He nails it. He nails it. You got to listen. Excited for you to listen. Here we go. Well, I'm gonna jump into stuff. You have a special.
Yeah. And... yeah. I don't know why I said it. Yeah.
I watched it. It's really good.
Thank you, dude.
We're gonna jump into the history too because I have to give you a lot of gas up here at the beginning because you I was into skateboarding when I was younger. You and I met through my older brother, yeah. And you were the cool skater dude who actually was really good at skating. And you took me skating. Here's the three things that you did for me. You took me skating, not once, but twice. You tried to teach me how to kickflip. I failed. You were cool with it. Then we went into the car. We got McDonald's, and you introduced me to Built to Spill.
No way!
Yeah, this was in the Volkswagen.
I was the coolest kid alive.
You were.
That dude, I'm so happy to hear that I was like kind to you, because I know I was also like a little like skate rat snob too, so I have this fear that I was like really vicious to everyone, so I'm really happy. And what a gentle band to introduce you to as well.
Yeah, I know. I was like, wow, what is, because I had watched your guys' skate video, and it was Stereolab's cover of St. Elmo's Fire, which I think was Brian Jarvis's video.
Wow, yeah, man.
And then there was Carry the Zero from Keep It Like a Secret, Built to Spill.
Yeah, which was used in those Trans World videos. Yeah, there's a bunch of, do you know Randy Placer? He's
okay,
like—
Okay, yeah, so it's a very small world, because I worked at a Starbucks. This is 2003.
Uh-huh.
And Randy was with, he might still be, I don't know, but he was with the woman, mm-hmm. and her best friend I worked with, because she was, didn't they move to China at one point?
Oh, I don't, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm not like super in touch with what's going on with him all the time, but that's
some
possible.
I
know
you are.
He's, yeah, well, I'm just a fan. I'm just a Randy super fan. I'm a fan of like, you know, there's like probably six incredible skateboarders that have come out of St. Louis, and he like went pro and stuff. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I'm just, I mean, we kind of know each other. But yeah, he has a kid and he lives in St. Louis now.
There
that
you go.
Much I know. Yeah, that much
There's
I know.
A bunch of people who are just coming back here. We're all washed up and we're coming back to St. Louis because you can't afford a house anywhere else.
Good for you guys. Man. Yeah, it's absurd out here.
Yeah, we still got regular drive-thrus. Fast food's very good out here. How often do you make it back to St. Louis?
I was there like a year ago.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit less.
Yeah. You got to come out more.
Yeah, I have a gnarly plane phobia. So anytime—
Wait, really?
I'm terrified.
You talked a bit about this on your special, but like it's you still have it?
I get on planes and I immediately start sobbing.
Oh.
So what's the downside? The downside is that it feels like somebody's pointing a gun at me. It's like so scary. So the last plane ride I went on, which was to Arizona. So it was 1 hour. So that was me. We were like, okay, we're going to do this to try and like dip our toes in the water. Mm-hmm. I get on the plane. I think I'm playing it cool. The attendant, what do we call him? The lady working there, whatever.
Yeah, flight attendant.
Flight attendant. She's attending the flight. And she looks at me. Three of them try to help me. That's how bad it is. And the last one comes up. She puts her hand on my leg. She looks directly into my eyes like a mother does to a child who's in trouble. And she goes, repeat after me. I am safe. I am okay.
Aww.
And I go, okay. And I just started doing it. And it didn't, it's not that I was no longer panicked, but it took the 9 down to like a 6. You know what I mean? And so afterwards I saw her, we were walking off the plane and I was like, hey, what's up? I was just fucking around. I was just messing around. I was cool. I was really cool up there. That was fun. And then I was like, I'm sorry. Thank you. You know? And she's like, don't worry about it. She's like, I have panic attacks, like nightly panic. So she's like, so I'm very familiar with this experience. That's why I know that that mantra works. So just if you're ever out there, anyone out there, if you're ever having a panic attack, repeating the phrase, I am safe, I am okay, does something to like calm your nervous system. And I very rarely get them anymore at all. And I've done like a lot of work around it and stuff, but planes. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, look, I have a hope that one day I'll be able to travel like a normal adult. We'll see. But yeah,
you're an actor, a comedian, a writer. You got to fly. You can't be John Madden.
Is that what he does?
It's what he did. He's dead now. He doesn't do anything. Yeah.
R.I.P.
lays down. But he didn't fly, and so he always had a bus.
Yeah, no, I know. I end up driving places. Like when I have to go home, luckily I love road trips.
So you would drive back to St. Louis?
That's what I did. I rented a Dodge Challenger and drove it back to St. Louis, and it's the most fun thing I've ever done.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were like in a Transformers car.
Yeah.
Zooming back.
Yeah. And this big stupid muscle head car, which they're so, it's like driving a fast tank. It's ridiculous. They're super fun. And it's zero, you know, whatever miles to the gallon gas.
So, you know, there is a, John Gabris talks about this once. His mom did it. There is a flight. It's like a flight safety, like flight anxiety sort of school. And it's sponsored by airlines. And you can do it. And it's like pretty cheap. And you go to these classes and they tell you like how safe flying is. And you learn about turbulence and they explain to you and you have all these pilots and they tell you all the training that the pilots go through. And then when you graduate, you go fly. And in New York, you fly from like, you take off at LaGuardia and you land at like Newark.
Oh, wow.
JFK. So you basically just go up, you do a little loop-de-loop around the city and you go there. And then you graduate, you know.
I have to do that. And we have a pilot friend who said he's going to do that, but I should just go to that school. I also love landing. Like once descent starts, I get so excited. Like I know people hate
it's over.
Yeah, people hate landing because it's like super rough. I don't. If the plane could explode into a fireball, but if it's on the ground, I'm fine. I just
it's fair.
I just don't want to fall through the air. I don't know why I'm up there.
Yeah, I hear you. I don't want to drive. I don't like driving in LA. Do you drive? You drive in LA?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, driving in LA sucks, but I do. Yeah. I do. It turns out I enjoy driving. Although the traffic here sucks. What don't you like about it specifically?
I don't like paying attention, first off. I also don't like the aggression. Mm. And I don't like people not using their blinkers.
Yeah.
I am a courteous, punctual driver.
Yes, yes.
And these people are not paying attention. There was some dumb video and it was Jason Bateman and he was eating a salad in his Tesla while his Tesla was on autopilot. Uh-huh. And I'm like, somebody punch that guy. Love, big fan of JB.
Sure.
Love Jason Bateman. Sure. I'm going to be very clear.
But development homie, to the Ozarks. You know, we're game for the career.
Ten and two. Get your hands on the fucking steering wheel, bro.
Well, here. Okay, so you're from St. Louis, Missouri, right? And so am I. And we have something in common with the South that we are part of an honor culture. I had this explained to me. So for us, politeness is like of paramount importance. Like if somebody's not being polite to me, I feel like they're trying to fight me, and they're not. They're just like going about their day. But and that's way different than like the East Coast, where if you're from New York and somebody's being overly nice to you, it feels rude. And it's exclusively a cultural thing. It's like having a different, like having a language barrier.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, people, there's a Minnesota vibe. I mean, let me be very clear. Missouri and Minnesota are two different states, everyone, despite the name similarity. Mm-hmm. And there's a thing called Minnesota Nice, where mm-hmm. people from Minnesota are really, really nice. But they also talk funny. I don't talk funny, and I'm nice. So I get a pass.
But that's not what Minnesota Nice means, though.
No. Well, Minnesota Nice means you just have a lot of manners, and you go above and beyond.
No, it means that you're nice to somebody's face, and then you're an asshole behind their back.
No.
Google it. I'm pretty sure. Dude.
I'm literally Googling this live. What does Minnesota Nice mean? It's a cultural stereotype applied to the behavior of people from Minnesota and Wisconsin, implying residents are unusually courteous, reserved, and mild-mannered against people who are not like them.
Okay, I'm totally wrong then.
Damn.
Well, that doesn't make sense that it has its own name when it just means nice. Like, you should just say nice then.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they are. There's a Midwest vibe about that.
I thought it was like the reference, like the same way they say, you know, Southern people say like, bless your heart when they mean like, I hate you or whatever. I thought it was that similar kind of thing.
I have never had that happen where someone told me bless your heart when I knew they meant I hate you.
No,
I'm
don't.
Just also oblivious.
I don't think it happens all the time. I'm just saying that that's a thing in the South where they're like, even when they do hate you, they will still be polite to you because it's an honor culture.
Okay, fair point.
So I think that's one thing. So and then for people who don't grow up with those, the importance of politeness for them, it seems fake because it has that potential. Like, oh, you don't really like me. You're just being kind. Whereas I'm like, I don't care if you hate me. Just be nice to my face. Just be a real sweetheart and we can all move on, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So you've been in LA how long now?
Since 2010, so 13 years.
Oh, geez. So are you a lifer?
I don't know if we'll end up here forever. I mean, I love it out here. I it's great.
What's your day-to-day? You go to Maru, you stand in line?
I don't know what Maru is.
Maru is the cool kid coffee spot in LA. There's a bunch of them.
Are there? No, dude, I'm off coffee. I don't drink coffee anymore.
So you're off everything then.
I'm off everything, dude.
Because you talk about this in your special that you're sober. I'm not outing you. You live on this. And you're not even drinking coffee.
Right, because everything I do it like a sociopath until I can't do it anymore. So I was drinking like 6 cups of $5 coffee a day and was like, why do I have an anxiety disorder? And it was because I was like so juiced and high on coffee all the time that I had to cut it out. I had to stop because I'm not in control. It's like everything else. Once I have one cup of coffee, it can easily turn into 15. And then, so it's not like I'm some saint. It's because I have such little control.
Wow. So what's your day to day? Are you making tea?
I'm having a smoothie right now.
Oh, okay. Well, how many smoothies do you have a day?
Like 1.5. Now my thing is, okay, so, and then this is nuts, dude. So I'm also, I haven't had sugar in like, I don't even know, 10 months.
Okay.
For the exact same reason. Because I was eating 3 bags of gummy bears a day and was like living in this world of like super high highs and then really intense depression.
Yeah.
And then I stopped eating candy like fucking... I stopped eating so much candy and my depression lessened like markedly.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations. You are walking on a tightrope across towers. Like, I don't know how you're doing this.
You just have to stay away from the first one. And you have to really like, and it's the same thing. Like, I smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for the first 8 years of my sobriety. Right.
Yeah. Which is a pretty common thing, right? It's just shifts. Yeah. Shift from one thing that's going to kill you or that's going to kill you to like something that's legal that might kill you 10 years from now.
Yeah, I think it's common if you're smart. Here's what I think. I think that people often they try to get sober and they're like, all right, dude, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to fucking run a marathon. I'm never going to smoke mm-hmm. again. When I think the reality is, yes, like what you're saying, I think is a great idea of like lean. They say like get rid of whatever's going to kill you first. So mm-hmm. like lean much deeper. Yeah. So I just did cigarettes for like woke up and smoke every day, all day long and loved it. I looked cool. I fucking felt great. I loved smoking, you know?
Cigarettes are, I mean this, is not a joke. I think cigarettes are still the coolest thing. You're breathing fire.
Yeah, yes.
It's like this, you're taming the evolution of man. I mean, it's incredible. I'm dead serious. I fucking love cigarettes.
Yeah, dude, and you're gesturing with smoke, so you're like a magician, but not nerdy. You know? They're amazing. And also like, it gives you something to do with your hands. I'm like orally fixated, all this stuff. So I just loved them. And then all of a sudden I had this, it's a like a boring story, but we went on a camping trip and I realized I didn't have any cigarettes and I was like shit. So I on day 2 I was like, oh my god, I'm not smoking right now. And then my dreams became really vivid and really intense, which happens when you stop something addictive usually.
Okay.
And I think my little theory is that it's because you're no longer blocking that aspect of your subconscious. Because I think, like, I'm using cigarettes to run away from feelings, right? I'm just, like, stuffing all this stuff. So I think I'm, like, pushing all this shit down. And so that when you let go of the addictive thing, all this stuff comes up from your subconscious and kind of filters into your dream life. Whoa. So like when I was drinking, I don't remember having dreams for probably like 4 or 5 years. And then when I stopped, I had this like really intense, gorgeous dream life. And the same thing happened when I stopped smoking cigarettes. And then, I was like stuck on this mountaintop with my partner and it was like, all right, I'm going to see if I can do this. So then you still have to go through the withdrawals of the experience, right? It's not like all of a sudden you're like free and easy, but if you can start to, for me, my experience, when I start to really like focus on the joy of it mm-hmm, or the new experiences that I'm gaining from it, that's when the perspective shifts for me. And now I love not smoking. Like if I walk next to somebody who's smoking, it smells like somebody like burnt a cookie and like put car exhaust on it. It's like the grossest thing. It's so awful. And I really enjoy like breathing deeply. You know what I mean? Like, so I've done both. I've like loved the addictive shit. And then now also I've experienced like the other side of it, which I like. Like I think that's better than having never smoked.
Wow.
You know?
I am curious what your take is on there's this like cool vibe now where everyone, especially in California, where I think for the first time in many years or for the first time period, it's more cool to be sober than it is, you know, because it used to be like drugs are cool and all that. And I think now like all my friends that, you know, are cool or identify as cool are very, you know, abstain from all drugs. Everything. You know, there's the Cali sober where it's like, yeah, I eat a gummy with my friends and we talk about, you know, whether or not Dark Side of the Moon was done, you know, but like it's now cool to just not partake in any sort of toxic substance.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you say, like mention the California thing, because I do think it's like geographical. Like I feel like New York was all drugs mm-hmm. and bars, of course, bar culture, but like heavy drugs. Chicago, mm-hmm. depending on where you're at, was like just beer culture. Just drink. And then out here, it's like tends to be more like, of course, weed and psychedelics, right? And so, I think that probably the California sober of being like, I'm sober, but I do mushrooms every 6 months. is probably the like standard over here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also look in New York. So I was there and every restaurant I went to also had a NA like cocktail list for the same price as regular,
right?
You know, cocktails.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a jasmine infused, yucca milk.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, cool. I'll try
hibiscus, yeah. Mint, jasmine, lavender, whatever.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. All sorts of scents and you know, flavors.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it's very interesting. And I think, you know, where it's easier to be vegan now. My wife, who is sober, she talks about how it's, you know, from other people that she's talked to and in support programs and stuff are like, oh, it's a lot easier now. And in terms of the outside world respecting your decision.
Yeah.
Not so much in that someone's struggle is easier. I want to be very clear about that distinction.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Totally. And especially too with like the opioid epidemic. Like it's just people have gotten more serious in their understanding of like the devastation of addiction, right? So it's like you generally know someone who's been affected by it. And it's like nobody talked about it for really, it's like everything. Like here's what my overarching philosophy is that in general, I'm going to use a California word right now, consciousness is raising. All right.
Ooh, okay.
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 Which is not to say that shit is not terrible. That is not to say that there's not plenty of awful stuff that's happening. But that is to say that we are now having to look at it in a way that we never had to look at it before, right?
Oh.
So by that, I think that there, because of that, I think people are like, and maybe it has something to do with the pandemic too, that people, as far as like people's sobriety, like people were able to take a look at their life and being like, oh, maybe I am abusing stuff for a reason that is not beneficial to me. Mm-hmm. And like, people can drink. It's no big deal. Like, there's nothing wrong with drinking. Do you know what I mean? At all. It's fucking, it's excellent if it's like good for you. And if it's not, it's not, you know?
Right. Yeah. Because you used your discussion of your sobriety and your journey with it. And the reason why I brought it up is it's a very large part of your special.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Which I'm psyched because I waited a very long time to put anything out, you know? Started doing stand-up in probably like 2007 or something. And then.
Was this in Chicago?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing an improv and sketch and stuff in St. Louis in like 2001. So it's just been a really long time of like doing a lot of live stuff and really loving that life and having a lot of beautiful experiences and touring and all that stuff. And then, you know, over the last like pre-pandemic, I started doing tons of mostly open mics and just like building this material and stuff. And it was cool because I felt like, oh, I actually do, having a long time sober now, I have a perspective on those experiences. I know how to make them funny and I know how to talk about them in a way that feels like honest to my own experience. And yeah, I just, you know what I mean? I just felt like I was able to say like personal stuff and have a perspective on it, you know, that comes from like having a bunch of time sober, which everybody doesn't have the opportunity, especially if you're like, I think it's hard if you're a known person and you're getting sober, because then you immediately have to start talking about it. And that's kind of dangerous because it's such a personal experience, you know, that it's like you're dealing with your own, you know, your perception of the world changing and being shifted entirely, right? It's like, it is like putting on, all of a sudden you put on like glasses and you didn't know you had bad vision, and it's like incredibly sunny out and everybody's really, really loud. That, you know, it's like, if you're a sensitive person and this like,
it's a strong visual.
Yeah. You know, this armor that you had is like gone. So the first early sobriety, it's like anything, like we're talking about, anything you could do to like stay sober is wonderful. And I think it's also good if you can, it's hard if you're like required to communicate to people why you're doing this or how you're doing it. You know what I mean? Or like what it feels like or any of this other shit in early sobriety. It's much better if you have a long-term experience with it. You could be like, oh, that's what it was like with 2 years. That's what it was like with 6 years. That's what happened at 13 years in. Okay, that's fucking crazy. You know, like,
yeah.
So I'm happy about that I think I was able to like, and also it's funny, like more and more it's funny, but you know, I was able to convey that stuff.
Well, I think there, you have to have a certain level, to go back to your consciousness word that you used, to now look at these things as funny. And I think in a way, I'm always a little bit taken aback when I hear any comedian speak about sobriety, because a part of me is like, well, wait, am I allowed to laugh at this? And I'm like, no, they're leaning on this. And, you know, I'm always kind of curious, like, do you find that that's almost like a redemptive aspect of the journey you've had, to be more open and vocal about it, where maybe some people might question their own use?
Maybe. I mean, I hope so. I don't know. It hasn't come out yet. So like, we'll see when it drops, how people respond to
it. Well, but obviously people have heard the material before.
Yeah.
This isn't, I mean, you didn't just go out and it was just from the palm of your hand. I mean, it, you'd, you know.
Yeah, no, it was all definitely like very workshopped stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, redemptive. I don't know. I hope so. I hope that it's good for people to hear. I think it is good for me to talk about it. I think, you know, if you're being funny, you're hopefully going to be funny about whatever's happening in your life. You know, I think it can be harder to make good shit funny. Like, it's much easier to be like, whatever, be like, yeah, here's my ninth divorce. You know what I mean? It's just easier to like, to be funnier with that shit, you know? But it's harder to be like, I do yoga now. Isn't that hilarious? Like, no one wants to laugh at that shit, you know?
That's kind of funny. Do you do yoga?
Occasionally. When I'm on my shit, I do yoga. Yeah, yoga was, you know, yoga was created as a preparation for meditation. It's like a deeply spiritual act that's been co-opted by white capitalism. to give you a cool stomach or whatever.
Wait, do you meditate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I have like a,
you got to walk me through on some of this. Cause I have tried to meditate many a times.
Mm, yeah.
And I end up being uncomfortable with myself.
Yeah.
And I end up kind of like laughing, cause I'm the person where I openly admit this, to where, like, you know, my grandma's funeral or whatever, I didn't really know how to behave. So I was kind of like making jokes.
Yeah.
Even then, like, this dead serious, my mom is recovering from breast cancer right now. Mm. She had a double mastectomy. And I was with her the other day. And I was like, Mom, I was like, are you cool if I use you as an excuse to get out of stuff I don't want to do for a while? And she was like, Jeremy. And she kind of laughed a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I don't really know how to sit in grief or things that are challenging for me on an emotional level. So I kind of will throw humor at
it.
And so when I meditate, I feel like I'm forced to sit with the emotions that I usually will put humor at to push away.
Yeah. Yeah, you are.
And then, exactly. And then I'm just like, well, fuck, I'm not doing this. I'm going to go try to run and listen to like Cigaros and cry when I do that.
Which is also great. I think that's you. What a powerful experience. That's, talk about good visuals. That's how cinematic I'm picturing you, like running.
Yeah,
blast
Max Richter.
And openly sobbing and like just like weeping.
Oh, I legit, almost every time I run, I end up starting to cry.
Wow, dude. That's when I stopped smoking cigarettes. Every time I would sit down and meditate, I would start crying for like a month. So I have a couple things about to say about this, about what you just told me,
please.
Which is, first of all, I think it's incredible that you know this, right? That you're like, oh, these are emotions that I laugh at because I'm uncomfortable. I think there's nothing. Mm-hmm. I think laughing at them is a gorgeous way to like process stuff. So I think my question would be like, why can't you sit there and laugh while you're trying to meditate? And I say that as a person who's like, when I, you know, knowing I meditate because it's so hard. It's so hard. It's like, I'm trying to do jokes about this on stage about how people are like, I can't meditate. The thoughts, they just keep coming. Like, of course they fucking, that's their thoughts. That's all they do is keep coming. Like, yes, that's all they do. Right. And what happens is that we're continually subject to these thoughts and we're not aware of it. And then you sit down and you start to steadily become aware of like, oh, I'm having all these thoughts. And some of them are extremely frightening. And so for me anyway, some of them are extremely like self-hating, you know? And I wasn't aware of that until I sat down and started like take note of this experience of what my thinking looks like, right? And then you can start to see like, oh, and again, as an aware person, this is not, what I'm talking about here is not something that you haven't experienced, right? It's not like, it's just a slightly, how do I say this? It's just a slightly shifted paradigm of what this looks like, of like, oh, there are my thoughts, which is how I perceive reality. And then there is reality, which is entirely different than my actual thoughts. And I know that because I sat still for 20 minutes and I had all these emotional experiences and all these different thoughts and nothing happened.
You mean nothing happened as in you conquered them? Or
no, as in I just sat here and nothing happened. I had all these thoughts about like why I'm angry at this person, why I'm sad about this thing, why I think this thing's hilarious, why I want this thing, why I shouldn't have worn that, why I shouldn't have said this. You know what I mean? This is all going on in your head while nothing has happened.
So what does the nothing mean?
What do you mean? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, if nothing happens, do you take action? Do you learn from it? I say this like for my own sake.
I think you start to recognize that there's a whole universe that is beyond this continual narrative that is running in my head. This like are tantamount to just a series of judgments, because the brain exclusively likes to judge. That's its job, but it's okay. It's just, it's designed to do that, but it's like, it's a tool that we, that is now the master, you know?
Yeah.
So when nothing happens, what that really is peace, but we confuse it with boredom because we're so fucking, and I'm saying this is, I'm not like some spiritual guru that I'm,
Man, this is a TED Talk.
I'm just as addicted to Instagram as any other dork. You know what I mean? Like, but also like I'm also aware of that. So I have to like, this is funny. I have parental controls on my phone that my fiance the password to, because I can't.
No. Explain this.
Because I can't have Instagram on my, I cannot have Instagram or Twitter or anything on my phone because I will lose all day to it. Like I'm so, as a person who's like, I always think people who have like addictive tendencies are like the canary in the coal mine, like, because I'm so addicted to that shit that I will lose 6 hours to it. I will lose an entire day to it. So I can't have it on my phone. I don't know how other people don't drink until they're blacked out. I don't know how other people like have Instagram on their phone. I really don't.
Well, I mean, I think you're picking at something here, which like I wrestle with this too. And that's the thing is where like, you know, I'm not saying that I'm the same as you, but I have definite like addiction issues with Instagram, with my identity, with my desire for materialism to assert myself because I have issues with my, you know, I weigh myself every day. I have horrible body image issues, all these things. And I have this like love-hate relationship with Instagram because I can look back at how Instagram has literally grown my career.
Mm.
Not by like a post I did,
yes,
but by like someone messaged me or I became friends with this person and the contact started on Instagram.
Yeah.
To where like that was my, in a weird way, Instagram was my bar that I could hang out at. And it's a dangerous place, but I was able to make really good connections and that those connections have helped me over time.
Yes.
But I can't quit it. And this is like a serious thing. I think about this every day because I pull it out and I see whatever activity's going on and I laugh at a few things and I check in on folks, you know, whatever it is. And I'm just like, fuck this thing, you know, like I've tried to turn it off when I'm trying to be more present around my kids, you know, and also like I'm not that we're the same, but like, you know, we're both self-employed per se. Yeah. And so it's like I sometimes how quick I can respond to a request is whether or not I get paid to do it.
Totally.
So it's like, well, crap.
Yeah, and by the way, like I don't think Instagram or any of that stuff is evil. It's the same as drinking to me. It's like, it's just a thing that exists. It's completely dependent on how you utilize it. And I use it. Yeah. I have great difficulty not using it in an unhealthy way, which only shows my like level of sensitivity and susceptibility, like shit that should not be a problem, you know?
I think for some people, it, you know, being aware that that is a problem, where other people, it's the exact same thing and they've just adjusted to it.
Right. Yeah, totally. And again, we're all kind of in this mess together. Like we're all victims of the algorithm or what I mean. They've done a wonderful job of like learning how to make this shit highly addictive to people, you know?
Okay.
But I think for me, the upside is that I've learned like, okay, now I need to, you know, for lack of a better term, develop and nurture some kind of spiritual life.
Okay.
You know, which to me is...
This was definitely heavy in your stand-up.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I called it...
Is Wayne real?
Yeah.
Okay. So Wayne is real. For listeners, Wayne is a big part of the stand-up. And my prediction, I was like, oh, I'm going to ask him. I was like, I bet Wayne isn't real. Or you're Wayne.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that if I were a better artist, I would have like made an amalgamation of people and turned them into one character. No, he's this beautiful person, man. He's this wonderful guy. And like, and I say that not to like try and kiss ass. I say that to... be loving about the struggle of addiction, which is in turns hilarious, the funniest thing in the world, and like a total tragedy. But also so fucking funny.
Do you even loop wheel, bro? Do you know what loop wheel garments are? I actually didn't, honestly. I was just like, oh, it's a flex. It's a special kind of cotton. Yeah, kind of. But the folks at Standard and Strange dropped a ton of knowledge bombs and their own incredible loop wheel tee. Made in Japan, of course. But back to Loop Wheel. It's an antique circular knitting machine that relies on gravity and uses spring bearded needles. Do you get it? Bearded needles? What the heck? Look, all you need to know is it's dope. It's better. And if you want to learn more, visit standardandstrange.com/loopwheel and check out their new Loop Wheel tees. Trust me, Your boy is partial to yellow because, you know, duh. But the tees are fire no matter what color you pick. The fit is spot on, and it's a classic tee that looks like it's from every era ever and fits like a dream. And it's from the folks from Standard & Strange, the shop that helps you own fewer, better things. Run by industry vets who are focused on incredible product from incredible vendors. And look, if that's not your vibe, check out some of their huge offerings of other Japanese denim or boots. But listen, the shirts, fam, the shirts, the loop wheel. So visit standardandstrange.com/loopwheel to learn more. Standard & Strange, own fewer, better things at standardandstrange.com. Oh, I mean, absolutely. Like one of my favorite quotes, and I'm going to pull this up because I think that anyone that's a comedian is definitely on a higher plane in towards enlightenment. Not kidding. So Mel Brooks has this quote that he said, and he said, comedy is the most powerful component of life. It has the most to say about the human condition, because if you laugh, you can get by. You can struggle when things are bad if you have a sense of humor. And the last thing he says is, laughter is a protest scream against death, against the long goodbye. It's a defense against unhappiness and depression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heavy. Heavy,
yeah,
right?
I talked about this recently in another thing, but I'll just say it again quick, that supposedly, and I think I heard this on an NPR thing, shout out to our sponsor, it was like, that supposedly the etymology of laughter, like where it comes from, is it was the first sound mm-hmm. that human beings made to indicate something that was neither food nor dangerous. So they would go like, ha, 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 look at this thing. So I think there's this ancient part of us that when we laugh shows us that if something is not dangerous. Like, so we can look at something that feels dangerous or seems scary. Like you're saying, these feelings that you have, right? And just through mm-hmm. the act of going, ha, 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 then you are now illustrating to yourself, like, you'd actually, there's nothing to be worried about, which I think is a kind of a spiritual thing, right? Because if you have a belief or a faith in a higher power, then you're like, oh, well, I'm a soul that can't actually be damaged. And like, people can do whatever the fuck they want, you know?
Yeah.
The parable about the monk or whatever that the we'll see. Have you heard that?
No, enlighten me.
Yeah, it's this monk. He like, what is this? I can't remember all of it, but he's like, he has a son, and everyone's like, oh my God, congratulations. It's so beautiful. And he's like, we'll see. And then his son goes off to war, and everybody's like, oh my God, that's so awful. And he's like, we'll see. And the son comes back from war, and he's like, that's so wonderful. And he's like, we'll see. And then he like gets a horse, and he's like, that's so wonderful. He's like, we'll see. And then the horse breaks his leg, and he's like, we'll see. You know what I mean? Over and over and over and over. And it just points to this idea of like, I mean, exactly what it illustrates. We're actually...
I was going to say he's a shitty dad. That's
no, that's it. What that story's about. Yeah, just a bad dad.
We'll see. Give me some fucking encouragement, Pops.
You're not bummed at all that I'm fucking going to the army now?
Yeah.
But yeah, just this concept that like, we actually don't know what's good and bad. We don't. And we think we do, right? We think continually asked to be like, this is bad. This is good. This is bad. This is good. This is bad. This is good. And it's like, the reality is you actually don't know how this shit's going to turn out.
Yeah, that doesn't make me comfortable.
Yeah, because it's ambiguity. You have difficulty with ambiguity, and we all do.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Because the brain doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, so I'm not going to deal with it, which is not healthy.
I don't know. I mean, is it or not?
Next thing you know, I'm blasting Max Richter, and I'm crying, and I'm like,
But what's wrong with that? I think it's amazing that you cry. So few people cry.
Oh, dude, I cry all the
time.
Did
you start crying more when you had children?
Fuck, yeah. I think I started crying more definitely when I had kids, and then also when, you know, my dad's health declined as bad. Even moving back here. Because I was like, oh man, shit. I left St. Louis as an 18-year-old kid to go figure out who I was and lived in New York for a long time. It was fine. And I came back in not the greatest situation, not like some prodigal son thing, but like I came back, you know, during COVID, all this weird uncertainty. And my dad is not in any state that I can have a relationship with him. And so sometimes I do wrestle and feel bad where it's like, did I miss out on every opportunity I had to have a relationship with my dad in the hedonistic pursuit of my own like self and understanding? And I feel really guilty for it. Where it's like, I could have had a strong relationship with him, and now I'm an adult and I have kids and I want his advice. Perfect example, I got a fucking flat tire, right? No big deal. Had a flat tire. I don't know how to change a tire. And I was like, damn, it would have been cool if my dad would have taught me how to do that. You know, and it's like, is that his job? Is it my job? Is it, you know, I mean, it was, I could look it up on YouTube. Then I solved the problem. But it was like, I was really upset that I wasn't here to learn that from my dad, or my dad didn't try to do that with me. And then it causes me to evaluate how I, you know, because I feel like every generation is a whiplash from the previous, right? And the values that they are raised by. So in most cases, you have a lot of emotional baggage that you bring into any relationship. It's called family of origin when people are talking about in psychology. And so, you know, how you were raised, you are going to, in most cases, push back against that in how you raise others. So especially if you weren't happy with the experience. And so I kind of sit with that a lot. And I think it's caused me to be much more emotional and grief of what I have no control over from the relationship with my parents. And then also what I have an illusion of control over with my kids, because I don't have control over them, you know? And I remember I was talking to my mom about this, and she was like, well, you know, I didn't realize this till later, but you raise your kids to leave you. And I was like, shit.
Wow. Dude, yeah. Well, your mom's coming with some heavy wisdom. Whoa. I've never heard.
Yeah, she's got
I've never heard that before. Yeah, that's a smoker, dude. Wow.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, man. And, you know, and she's like, so don't abandon your own relationships with your partner, your spouse.
Whoa.
She said spouse. She didn't say partner. But she was like, but don't abandon that. She's like, because they're there forever.
Right.
And she's like, a lot of people will push someone else away into their own sort of self-discovery or whatever it is. But what I didn't realize.
Which, by the way, is hard on the kids also. That's a huge amount of pressure on your children. And you can't help but ultimately there has to be a little bit of resentment against them too that comes up if you're like, oh, you know, I gave up my whole life for you.
Yeah. I mean, a good friend of mine who's an actor, I won't say his name on this, I told him that when I was moving to St. Louis, and he was like, dude, you just put your career like 10 steps back. And I was like, well, I got to take care of my kids. He's like, I get it. He's like, but this is the thing that I don't know if you realize. He's like, it's going to happen. And he wasn't being mean when he said it, or they weren't being mean. She wasn't, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I understood it more at the sacrifice I would make. But I want to. Like, I want to give my kids a standard of life that I didn't have. So yeah, they go to fancy, expensive Montessori schools where they're playing with dirt and, I don't know, learning about, you know, bugs and stuff. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But all of these things, to come full circle, have made me extremely emotional and sensitive, especially towards things to be grateful for, you know, and I try to be very conscious of it when I do the pod, when I do all sorts of things. Cause it's like, yeah, you know, I had a shitty day, but to a bunch of people, I'm living the dream. And even though I'm a ball of anxiety 9 times out of 10, like, you know, in a weird way, someone is envious of my situation. And I should be more grateful for it. And I know that's a shame mentality. That's actually shaming myself into being grateful instead of being grateful for the sake of it. And but that's where I try to get into, I don't know, like I've gotten really into religion, like various forms of it and all sorts of stuff where, because I'm like, well, surely like if I can tap that, I can just fix things. But yeah, it's heavy shit. Yeah, I don't really know how to handle it
there,
all.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wow, you just said so much. Thank you for sharing on
it. Sorry.
No, it was great.
This is your episode.
Not anymore, baby. You fucking... You strong-armed
it. Game over.
Back to my comedy special.
Well, no, but I think that's why what the dots I was trying to connect to is I think people that are comedians, they don't realize it, but I think it's the highest calling anyone could have, because you have to help other people be more okay with the state of life that they're in. So you call out all the ridiculous things that people can laugh at, and then you walk away. And everyone who, you know, for me, after I watched your special, I mean, it was... I'm serious. Yeah, I loved it. And it's not just because we're homies. Like there was stuff there that I was like, wow. I was like, one, I'm super happy for Mort because sounds like he's processed a lot. But two, that you're thriving despite of what you've gone through.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you say about the comedy thing. About being a higher calling. I think it's a tool like anything else. I understand that there are certain aspects of Eastern religions that talk about how you have to be really, really careful with what kind of music you listen to. It's not that they're anti-music, it's that they recognize the power of music and that it can like get into your heart whether you want it to or not. And I think comedy is an interesting thing where you can do it in a toxic way. Like if you're starting from a foundation that is untrue, then I don't think it's always like very helpful. But if you're trying to start from a place, because there's different kinds of truth, people say, like, comedy is just telling the truth. It's like, sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know what I mean? Like, was Andrew Dice Clay telling the truth? You know what I mean? Like, kind to him, he was. And also, like, people like him, whatever, it's fine. But if you're starting from a foundational place of, like, you can say shit that is funny from that place, but I disagree with the foundational premise, you know? So I also think it's like, it depends on the way that you utilize it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sir. I don't think get or done is causing me to look at myself from a different perspective or question.
Yeah. And not even, and of course, not also, and also not that it all has to be like Nanette style, whatever, like emotional exploration. Either you could just be, I love this dude, Brad Wenzel. He, you know, he's just silly as shit all the time. Like, I'm down for just absurd, silly one line. I think all that stuff is completely beautiful. I guess I'm talking more about, like, there's kind of like a toxic comedy that's just sort of like weird. Do you know what I mean? That's fairly popular.
Yeah.
But then, so yeah, I don't know, man. It's it is a really, really powerful thing. What religions have you checked out?
Okay, so when I was younger, I was really into Buddhism.
Mm.
And I had met a woman that I was very much in love with, and she was also Buddhist, and she, you know, but she was also, you know, I say this in hindsight, she was also like Madonna, Kabbalah, you know, stuff, where I think she was more interested in the vanity of it. I mean, obviously we're not together anymore. But I was like, well, I can't half-ass anything. If I'm going to do this, I'm really going to try to go deep. And I got into that. And then I was like, well, the whole point of this isn't fulfilling to me. I was like, this enlightenment, this numbness. I was like, I really, as much as I want joy, I also feel like I learn a lot from grief and pain. And I think those emotions are extremely important. And I'm not saying, I'm no authority on Buddhism. Let me be very clear. But I was trying to not casually observe or participate in that. And then I was like, well, you know, and a friend of mine's, you know, you should really read about Confucius and get more into that. And then I was like, okay. And I started getting more into Confucianism. And the cool thing is, when you're in New York, there's a group of people for whatever you're into.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to do that. And I was like, you know what? This isn't really working either. And then, you know, I was very much against Christianity, specifically because of my dad being a pastor. But my dad was like, look, I don't care what you're into. He's like, you just need to have faith in something. He's like, whatever it is, he's like, you don't have faith in anything. And I think if you don't have faith in yourself or some sort of other religion or thing, he's like, you're just always going to be empty. You're just going to be walking around upset. And knowing how he felt about Christianity and how important it was to him, because he really detested the modern, you know, especially of like what people think of when they think of Christianity now. Now, from just like far right wings and Trump and all that stuff. I mean, he would hate it, you know. But he was like, you just need to have faith in something, because you're going to get to the end of yourself and you're not going to know what to hold on to. And he was, you know, and I remember he was like, that's the best thing of you not living here, is he's like, you need to find out like who you are. And I was like, oh yeah. And I wasn't just like blowing lines and banging chicks. I mean, this wasn't like the sort of stuff I was doing. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, trying to play music and stuff like that. But you know, and then I was like, well, maybe I'm just going to, you know, I dated a Jewish woman, and she was like, oh, you know, let's go to temple. It's, you know, I was like, oh, cool. I could be into this. I'm like, you know, there's some Jesus stuff, you know, you're not into, but you're into all these other Bible things. Okay. I'm, you know, and again, I was just like getting deeper and deeper. And then I met you know, of course these tend to be connected to different women I dated. And then it was like, Scientology. I started getting into that, and then I was like, okay.
Oh, fuck, wow.
And I just backed away from everything. And now, you know, I would say I'm into God and the concept of Christianity, but I'm very much not into Christians or Christian culture. But I think it becomes, you know, I continue to read more books about theology than I do anything else. You know, and a lot of it, I think I got into Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, which is, you know, kind of a bedside book for any sort of wannabe intelligent. You have Infinite Jest and, you know, Man's Search for Meaning on your nightstand. Cool guy. With your monocle. But like that definitely made me reevaluate stuff. And now, you know, I'm still kind of in the same spot, but my kids, especially Harriet, she wants to go to church.
Mm.
And I'm like, shit.
How old is
like,
she?
Well, 5 and a half.
Uh-huh, wow.
So I'm still kind of walking the line of, I don't want to program my kids, but also I'm like, you know, this is a desire she wants, you know. And it's funny, because my, you know, Sean, my brother, whom you also know, you know, he's very much like, I'm not letting them do anything. And I'm like, well, you're actually doing the opposite, because in some cases your kids want to do certain things and you're actually depriving them of it, versus in pursuit of protecting them. There's a big difference. You know, They don't want to go jump off a bridge. They want to experience something different. And based on your experiences, you're trying to, you know, shield them from that, which is also fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're saying he's not going to let them do anything in regards to like religion or do anything?
In regards to religion.
Oh, yeah.
He's
okay.
Like, well, we had to go to church all the time. And I'm like, well, yeah, well, fucking like,
yeah.
We were still conscious human beings. You still decide on what you want to do.
Yeah.
If your kid wants to go to church, let him go to church.
It depends on the kid, too. Like, I've noticed, I listen to a ton of skateboarders talking just because I like skateboarding. I noticed this pattern that a lot of them had skateboards taken away from them for a while, or threatened to be taken away from them, or weren't able to get a skateboard for a really long time. And I think it can be the same thing if you're a kid who's like into religion or something and your parents won't let you explore it. The desire is just going to grow and grow.
Bingo.
And it's going to come, yeah. You know what I mean? It's going to become a bigger thing.
Even now with parenting, a lot of people are like, don't, you know, you want to protect your kid, but it's like, don't lead with something that they can't. Right.
Oh, yeah, like, sure. Right.
Like a perfect example. So like Harriet, all of a sudden she thinks farts are funny,
yep.
Which is like, yeah,
she's great.
No shit. Of course they are. And
you said
I was like, hey,
no
like
fucking
you-
shit.
You know, and she was like, Dad, I want, you know, make a fart noise. And I'm like, hey, please don't, you know. That's not appropriate right now. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Right.
But what I didn't realize is I'm actually kind of making it a little bit more enticing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, well, I'm not really supposed to do that.
Which
well,
is part of why out. They're hilarious too, because that's also like in the case in general, polite society.
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, it's all these things. It's caused me to cling actually to comedy more than ever. And I think that's just like the age that I'm in and what all my friends are in is we're in these weird existential moments of, you know, elevated long-term relationships and reevaluating how we understand materialism and, and socioeconomic status, you know? I mean, and I think it's an age thing, but it's all of my friends are in the exact same boat. It's just like, yeah, you know what? Maybe I do that. Or because I'm lucky enough that most of my friends, no one is concerned about whether or not they're going to die or eat or, you know, they all have food and shelter. They all have all the basic, you know, needs.
Right.
And so it's just caused them to focus on things that like maybe you neglected.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah. Also, I think there's, you know, I just don't think it's a mistake that there's a lot of different opportunities to allow people to explore those kinds of these sort of like questions of existence or consciousness in a bunch of different areas, right? It's like, to me, you're a seeker. That's what you're doing. You're seeking,
yeah.
You know, and we say like, it's in the seeking. It's not in the finding, because I think
yeah.
The mind wants you to get to a point where you're, okay, this is my belief in God or whatever. This is what the faith is, you know, whereas like my practice is more about like, okay, what aspects of these different belief systems can I take that I find beneficial to my life? Like when I was in my 30s, and this is apparently not uncommon as far as like psychological development, I started to get hit with this really, really intense fear of death. And I'd never even considered it at all, right? And it really did start, and I looked at some like Thich Nhat Hanh, and then I started to get deeper into that stuff, and that sort of his ideas, his concepts of like, where he's like...
It's like reincarnation.
Yes, that's an aspect of it, right? Yes, and
sure.
Also there is a natural changing to the world, to everything that exists in the organic, natural world. And human beings, because of our intellect, think that we're separate from all this. And in reality, we're not at all. And I just found this incredibly... And for me, it just made sense. Like there's just stuff that I can take from these experiences that are like, oh, I'm adopting that into my spiritual belief system because that is, I view that as a loving perspective.
Damn.
Which is an antidote to this fear that we're given, which is like, look, the only way we're ever taught to deal with death is through abject fucking terror. That's it. Mm-hmm. We never see it. It's completely hidden. And every action movie and every movie, the worst possible thing that could ever happen to a human being is that they could die. So of course we're fucking scared of that. You know what I mean? But then there are like these ancient systems which have a certain level of wisdom around that stuff because they're like millennia old. You
right.
Know? And there have been people who have there are generations and generations and generations of people who have dedicated their entire lives to the loving study of the universe in a way that they can articulate this stuff that if you're open to it can be extremely relieving, I find it to be. And that was really important to me. And again, it wasn't because I was like, I want to get into crystals. It was like, look, I can't fucking sleep because I'm so scared of dying. Like somebody help. You know what I mean?
Do you sleep okay now?
No.
Why not?
I have
more, you have the greatest life. You're a comedian, you're an actor, you live in California in beautiful weatherland. You got a cool cat, you got a nice pad, you got a good partner. What
yeah.
What's wrong?
I mean, it's a big question. I don't know. I had gnarly trauma as a child. It's generational. My dad doesn't sleep. He's up till like 6 a.m. all the time. Like my sister doesn't sleep. None of us sleep. And I've done everything. I don't know. I've heard a couple different things. You know what I mean? Like there's these, I have ADD. I was diagnosed with ADD as a child, right? There's this, this theory called the Night Watcher theory. Oh. I love this.
Marvel movie?
Yeah, exactly. That's the Nightcrawler theory that you're like Jake Gyllenhaal. You're a fucking a creepy news photographer.
That's a fucked up movie.
Yeah. Ahead. I love him like trying to be not hot. Is still like, well, you're still fucking Jake Gyllenhaal. You're not like actually creepy. You know, you're like Hollywood.
Very true.
Well, anyway, great performance. But supposedly way back in the day, there were people in the tribe who were tasked to stay up all night and view the horizon to watch for danger. And a huge aspect of ADD is the total inability to regulate your sleep, and it like it's really damaging. It like affects relationships and your ability to have a career, and it's all this other stuff. And the theory is that these are the people who were tasked to like watch the night. So I'm like, I love staying up late and watching like action movies, and when I lay down to sleep, exactly like you're talking about your experience when you try to meditate, that's what happens to me when I try to go to sleep. And I've never fallen asleep on accident ever in my life. Like, you know how people are like, I fell asleep on the couch, like that's never happened to me. It's always been an experience of having to like make a real concerted effort to go to sleep.
Whoa.
Yeah. I've also heard that like certain people are on 36 hour sleep cycles instead of 24 hours. That also makes sense to me. Like I start to wake up and feel really good around 10 p.m.
Perfect if you're a comedian.
Yeah.
Those are pretty good hours.
Yes, exactly. So right, man.
When do you usually go to bed?
Last night I laid down at 9:30 and I fell asleep about 2 o'clock.
And what did you do between the hours of 9:30 and 2 a.m.?
I laid there.
Interesting.
Yeah, and usually I can't. Usually I have to get up and like watch skateboard videos or something.
Do you ever skate? Do you go full Rodney Mullen and you just go find a random?
No, I'm not even using the time wisely. Like I'm just totally like watching like car videos on YouTube or watching the new fucking Palace video or something. Which, dude, you should watch. You should watch Kyle Wilson's part in the last Palace video. He's got the first part, and this dude, he's got style like no one I've ever seen. You're gonna go nuts for his clothes.
That's right. I'm going nuts for his clothes. What is he wearing? All Palace head to toe?
No, he's wearing other stuff, but he's got like do-rags and like big jean shorts, and he's got I think he's got like, he's like Stevie Williams meets like Wade DeSarmo.
Okay. I know exactly what you're saying when you say
Yep, he's real.
Here's an honest question.
Okay.
We're going to pivot away from some of the existential shit. Why do you think skateboarders are always like leaders of culture?
I am so psyched you asked that question. Because they are inherently rebellious and autonomous and on their own, and they're in the streets, and part of the activity is based so heavily on aesthetics and individualized aesthetics, as opposed to like a basketball player. Like basketball players finally started to wear really, really cool clothes at the press conferences, right? But it's like, imagine if the NBA was only a dunk contest and you could wear whatever clothes you wanted.
That's pretty sick.
That's skateboarding, right? It's like, and not only that, but it's inherently anti-property ownership. So it's inherently anti-capitalistic, and that's why people fucking hate it. And then for a long period, we were talking about this, you could entirely engage with skateboarding and never purchase anything corporate for like a really long time before like Nike and Adidas actually kind of started to do a good job of, you know, like sponsoring good skateboarders and hiring skateboarders to run their programs, right? But so skateboarding is like, it's just, it was built out of the orphans of society. And those people created their own aesthetic-based form that is very deeply connected to like kind of underground, unseen street aspect of American society. So in the early 90s, skateboarders, they started to dress like fucking orphans, right? For a while, the fashion got kind of co-mingled with like rave culture. And so they started to wear these like super giant pants. They called it the Goofy Boy era. And they had these like giant shirts, and they were just dressing like, oh, this is what I dress like when no one cares about me, because I might as well look like a Dickensian orphan because no one likes. So like, fuck you. And like my hair is in braids. And I don't care what you think about me because you already hate me because you want me out front. You don't, you want me away from your storefront or whatever. Right. So then,
right.
You know, okay. You know what I mean? So then in the mid 90s, like where, which is like my favorite era of aesthetically what it looked like is like, then it started to get really intertwined with hip hop culture. And it was like somewhat appropriative, but also like, it also just was part of the culture itself. Like it truly was. So that experience of like the fashion of hip hop co-mingling with kind of the fashion of skateboarding was like this really tasteful, beautiful, cool, extremely cool aesthetic that was built by like the children that nobody cared about.
Mm.
You know, like hip hop comes from restructuring music because they didn't have access to instruments because they fucking took away the music programs. And skateboarding is all about the restructuring of benches because they refuse to play baseball, right? So it's like there's an art form involved in recontextualizing this shit at the risk of sounding like overly academic. Does that make sense?
No,
so
I mean,
it's like you're taking shit because you don't have access to that much. It's not like snowboarding where you got like $600 to go on top of a mountain. You know what I mean? Like you're just going directly in front of your house in the city.
No, you're exactly right.
So that's why they're on the why they're on the forefront of shit, and everybody else is like after them because you know, because that's how cool shit gets burned.
I mean, still in my head, when I think of someone that, you know, I want to look cool, and this is pre-Tony Hawk, it's always Andrew Reynolds. You turned me on to Andrew Reynolds.
Mm.
This is way early, you know, because it was like the jeans and, you know, I don't think in most cases when I'm, you know, if you're not familiar with Andrew Reynolds, he's a professional skateboarder, but he I mean, it was just very simple stuff. It was like black 501 jeans and a white t-shirt and something like that.
Yes,
you know,
so,
like,
yes. So and then so this is the end era Reynolds, right? This is like bigger jeans.
Yes.
Before he went punk. Yes, okay, great. Bucket hat. Yes. Button-up pledge.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
And like that is something I've tried to emulate all the time when I get dressed, and I know I can never hit it. One, because I'm not Reynolds, and obviously I'm not, you know, I could never really skate well. But there was a je ne sais quoi for, you know, there was just this ease.
Yes.
And I want to like journey through my life with that same ease.
Yes. Because
even though I know that Reynolds is obviously has had his own demons. I mean, he's sober now, et cetera, but like there was something there. When I understood him, it was in a different light.
Oh, yeah. No, he was incredible and always has been. He's one of the most probably influential skateboarders. I mean, of course, there's like many, many arguments to be made. Mark Gonzalez, Guy Mariano, whoever. But I mean, the dude is made. He has this like incredibly long standing skateboard company. He's 40 something and he's still skating. He's putting out parts, which is unbelievable. But well, and those there's still people that are trying to like hit that kind of 90s. There's this dude named Tom Snape, who I think hits it really well. It really is this specific cut of jean, which I'm sure you know more about than I do. But people have moved away from it because I feel like skateboarders now are dressing closer to the early 90s than the mid 90s now. With the exclusion of a couple different people, right? But it's like, but yeah, that's the thing. The clothes are as a huge part of the entire enterprise, right? Like it really is you're saying who you are by intentionally choosing what you wear. So like when those guys went punk, I believe that they're the reason people started. I believe that Ali Bulala, Jim Greco, those people are responsible for people wearing tight pants. No one wore tight pants. And those dudes came out and they started dressing like Richard Hell and the Sex Pistols. And then 7 years later, people started like pants started to slim up a little bit, you know? And like, I remember, I remember like people making fun of me for wearing like brown cargo pants. And then 4 years later, everyone in high school was wearing them. And it wasn't because I'm smart. It's because I was looking at these skateboarders who also, by the way, are on the coasts. And as we know, that's like where fashion comes from. Well, but yeah, it's a hard thing to articulate, but it's like, because it's not just the wearing the clothes, it's how the clothes move and it's how you move in the clothes. So when those dudes went punk, there's sort of this thing happened in my mind where like, and people, they don't love that era of Reynolds, but I really love it, partially because that was like a powerful time in my life. I saw him, I went to the premiere of This Is Skateboarding in New York and like shook his hand and told him he had a great part. And to me, he was wearing super tight pants and leather jackets, and he was dressing just like exclusively rock and roll as shit. And he was like front side flipping the Love Park Gap. And there was something so in my mind, because he's so tall and skinny, there was something like really vulnerable about the way that he was dressing and the way that he skates. He, yeah. They call him like danger hands now. I call him like 90s hands. Like he tends to put his hands up slightly. Like he's not full bore aggression style. He's not like Tom Penny, like incredibly smooth, although he is very, very smooth. But because of his height and the shape of his body, there's something a little bit vulnerable of like, fuck, you don't want him to fall. And especially then when he was like all messed up on cocaine or whatever, it was like he had this look of like a dude who was not doing great, barely didn't seem like he skateboarded that much at all, and then would step on his skateboard and do the gnarliest shit. And that's like, and also these dudes are all making choices with their dresses, with their clothes, of like, okay, now I like when an article, a series of, you know, an outfit tells a story, for lack of a better term, right? I know that's kind of a cliched thing, but it's like, okay, what's your thing? You're like, you're a hungover, barfly, coke addict, damaged dude who's also one of the best skateboarders in the world. That's pretty sick.
So if you connect skateboarding and comedians, do you think it's in the fact that there is a recklessness vulnerability?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I think skateboarding is one of the few things that's harder than stand up. And physically, you know, stand up is really, really hard emotionally. I mean, I'm trying to like figure out how to fucking get some new material and it's so hard. And
Still acting, right? I mean, because, I mean, you were, the last thing I saw you was Mythic Quest. It looks like you have some other stuff that's in the hopper.
Yeah, I'm on Mythic Quest. I think there's going to be another show coming out that I'm going to do a little bit of work on. But yeah, I haven't been auditioning for stuff anymore, which has helped me focus more on stand-up, which has been really cool. I mean, I'm down to try and, I have yet to decide if I'm going to try and get another manager or not, because I think that auditioning for TV shows, while it was a really, really cool experience, I think it was a little bit distracting from like acting. Like, I think the reason I was able to do the special is because I had a bunch of time off from auditioning for television shows, because that just takes up a huge amount of like emotional bandwidth basically for me.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think skateboard, I mean, it's hard. It's fucking hard. You have to try to do a kickflip 10,000 times to do one. And then you do one and it's really bad. Like, it's not a good kickflip. And you have to do 10,000 more for him to be, and that whole time you're like getting really hurt. And now I'm like, I'm trying to get new material. So I just fucking, I got COVID because I did stand up in Hollywood. And I'm pretty sure that sentence has COVID. And then I was like, just 7 days out. And I got to try to go to these open mics and like work on my new stuff. And I think we all go through this phase of like, this shit's not good. It's not funny. It'll never be funny. Like, there's no way it could possibly be funny. When I know from experience that like when I work on it a lot and really dedicate to myself to it, I can come up with good shit, which I have.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people, when they talk about comedians, no one really doubles down on the fact that most comedians bomb a lot. And there's got to be some sort of resilience. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe I'm the one that's projecting here on the skateboarding thing, where it's like, you don't really do that good that often. You know, it's like any sort of sport where it's like, if you can do good 15% of the time, you know, I'm sure there's a baseball analogy in there too, which I don't give a shit about. But like, if you can do good just that small percent, like, then you made it. Like, you're still a incredible artist.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though you might spend more time failing than more.
And not only, there's an ego to it too, which is, I am the art. That's the fuck, that's the egoic, through line. Do you know what I mean? Of like, everybody's in skateboarding, right? Everybody's going to fucking watch, they're going to point cameras at me and they're going to watch me do this thing and I'm going to fucking fail and throw a tantrum and like, you know, hit a cop or whatever crazy shit I'm going to do, or, you know, run from a security guard or whatever. And then with stand up, I think, and again, this is the other side of what I'm talking about. Like the kind of stuff that I try to do, I can go too far into the self-indulgent thing as opposed to like kind of the toxic thing, which is a concern. But like everybody look at me, everybody deal with every fucking emotion that I have. You know what I mean? And like, let me try it. Mm-hmm. But if you can make all that shit funny, it's really, really powerful. But you run if it's not funny, you like, that's the risk I'm running all the time. It's like, oh, I'm just standing up here being like kind of loud and annoying and kind of whining, or really like pretentious in the shit that I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you know?
Damn. Do you still skate?
I roll around. Like I try. I mean, I have a board. I left it at this fucking stand-up club the other day and I think it's gone. So now I only have a cruiser. But I still roll around. There's this skate park right up the street from me, but it's huge. Like, they built all these skate parks that 1% of skateboarders can fucking skate. There's like giant bowls and stuff. And also you can't go in there without pads. So it's like this, you know, multi-thousand-dollar park, and it's a bunch of like 4-year-olds on scooters in full gear, which is fine, but like, they don't need a 10-foot bowl. Like, give them a couple curbs and a quarter pipe and they're fine.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I remember the only skate park was in Columbia when I would skate, and we would go there, and it was just massive bowls, and I was way too, I could barely drop in on anything, you know? And it was like, there was one mini, it was like maybe like an 18 inch tall rail, and there was like a line to try and do tricks on the rail, which I of course ate shit on every single time. And I just remember that was like the first and the last time I went, I was just like, this is ridiculous. Like, everything here is, you got to be like level 99, and I can't even do the like lower level shit. I mean, it was very interesting to go to that and a lot of the other parts.
I know, because I know exactly what you're talking about, because it had this like bowl section, and then it had the rail and a ledge right next to it, but the rail was like, there was a big bank here and then a big quarter on this side, and the rail went in the middle of it. Yeah. When like the optimal skate park is just that rail and then another bench and then like two quarter pipes. That's all you need. Whereas like they're trying to pack in like four pyramids, three like ledges, and then two weird like bank half pipey thing. You know what I mean? Like, they're just trying. They
played the video game and were like, oh, this is what the kids want. Let's just copy this game.
Yeah, you don't understand flow. And especially like the older you get, you know what I mean? It's why people just build what the kids gravitate towards. Where do they want to go? They want to go to the plaza that just has the fucking ledge and some stairs. That's all. You know what I mean? They just want to like get high and like flop around on that shit. Just let them do that. You know?
Yeah, damn. I knew we would discuss skating, but didn't expect to merge the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're both, you know, they're both like, they both involve some sacrifice. That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know. But so does everything else. That sounds like, I don't know, I'm not trying to act like it's like the most,
it's all right. Everything's relative.
Totally relative. It's way harder to like build a house. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, yes, I'm sure it is. And that's the thing. That's the like the starving kids and whatever response when anyone has a bad day. It's like, well, you could be starving in wherever, you know, in insert country, could be starving in the United States, you could be starving, you know. And I think that's a weird defense thing that people throw up when you know, they just want to minimize their own.
Yeah, I will just say I am incredibly grateful for skateboarding and comedy, because I mean, that's the reason I, you know, and music too, like that's the reason I gravitate towards that shit, is because it does help me feel like lighter when I feel troubled, in a troubling spot, you know.
Yeah, damn, heavy shit.
Fuck.
I mean, this was, I'm really, really glad we got to chat today.
Yeah, me too, man. Thank you so much for having me, dude.
It was great talking to you, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, buddy. Thanks.
You've been listening to Blammo. Our show is produced by Blammo Media. We're edited by Amar Lowe, and our theme music, as always, by the mysterious Break Master Cylinder. If you like what you heard, share the pod with a friend, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, do the deals. I think you can like rate us on Spotify now too. Who knew? What magic world we're in. Follow us on Instagram for all the hot content at Blammo Podcast. And if you want to talk to us and give us your hot take, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@blammopod.com. Last but not least, if you want to hang out with us and join the Blam Fam, yep, bad name, better group, visit patreon.com/Blammo, where we have tons of exclusive, top secret episodes in our amazing, incredible, wonderful, incredible, I don't know, I'm running out of adjectives and superlatives Slack community. They're all in there. Thanks so much for listening, folks. We'll see you soon.